Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. It has been a great delight over many years to watch the intelligence and the skills of our first guest in trying to clarify some of the most important fronts in this war for the free world, namely in the Middle East, particularly through the halls of Congress. Her name is Sarah Stern. She is the founder and president of the Endowment for Middle East Truth, simply known as EMET. It is a marvelous organization advancing American and Israeli vital interests on Capitol Hill and elsewhere. She writes prolifically, including in all the right sorts of outlets. She has also been the author of Saudi Arabia and the Global Islamist Terrorist Network, and also a novel entitled Cherished Illusions. A great friend and always welcome guest, Sarah Stern. Thank you so much for joining us. Welcome back.
Thank you so much, Frank. It's an honor and a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Let me talk to you first about Gaza. Remind us of what is the nature of the Gaza Strip, Sarah, and why at the moment are we seeing the kinds of aggressive action by the terrorist group that runs it, known as Hamas, threatening, it seems, intensifying violence over the next 6 weeks at least?
First of all, I think it should be very clear to our listeners that the Gaza Strip is not currently under Israeli occupation. In 2005, which is 13 years ago, in what was a heart-wrenching, politically divisive move, the Israeli government decided to uproot any remnant of a Jewish presence in Gaza and withdrew entirely to the pre-1967 lines, giving the Palestinian people their total independence. At that point, Jewish philanthropists actually bought the greenhouses to give what they thought would be a nascent Palestinian state, some sort of economic infrastructure. And some rabbis wanted to leave the synagogues in Gaza, arguing that they should be turned into mosques because, after all, we all pray to the same God. As soon as the last Israeli troop left and the blue and white flag of the State of Israel was lowered, those greenhouses and synagogues and any vestige of a presence in the Gaza, a Jewish presence in the Gaza Strip, were destroyed in a frenzied, hate-infested atmosphere of chaos and mayhem.
Which generally, it seems, characterizes the state of Gaza on a regular day, does it not?
Exactly, exactly. And so much so that the Egyptians have chosen to totally seal off the border with Gaza. In fact, if medical supplies or emergency aid has to go into Gaza, they go through the Rafah checkpoint, which is the Israeli checkpoint, not through the Egyptian one. The Egyptian one is hermetically sealed off.
And Sarah, this is just one example, as you know so well, of the disconnect between the reality on the ground and what we are endlessly told by Israel's critics at the UN and in other capitals, including now increasingly, it seems, in our own country. I did want to ask you quickly to talk about several other flashpoints, if you will, for Israel, and I would argue for our interests in the region as well. The northern border that Israel shares with the Hezbollah-dominated nation of Lebanon, point one and point two, well, Hezbollah, an Iranian-dominated, it seems, increasingly at least, government and country of Syria. Tell us about what these portend for Israel's security and our interests.
Wonderful. Actually, because of be absolutely irresponsible. JCPOA, or the deal that was brokered by President Obama with the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iran has been enriched, empowered, and enabled. And because of the huge influx of money, including $150 billion of the released frozen assets and $1.6 billion in exchange for our hostages in the last minute, all of the Islamic groups, particularly the Shiite groups, have been empowered and emboldened. And there is a land bridge stretching from Tehran all the way to the Mediterranean in Lebanon. There are at least 150,000 missiles staring down at Israel right now from both Syria and Lebanon in particular.
Capable of ranging the entire country of Israel, as I understand it now.
Exactly. Exactly. Israel lacks the strategic depth to be able to absorb this sort of blow. And this has been so, so highly irresponsible. And right now, Syria is really in play because Iranian troops are in there. The IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, is there. The Al-Qassam Brigades, they are the Al-Quds Force and Hezbollah. And of course, we see that when America retreats, nature abhors a vacuum. America, like it or not, is the policeman of the world and has to be. And we see that Erdogan Turkey is going into that theater, and the mullahs from Iran and Putin, they're all the moral cockroaches of the world are trying to flex their muscles in Syria, which is, of course, you know, right on Israel's borders. But it's just as importantly, this is extremely, extremely critical for the national security interests of the United States.
I can take it very quickly, Sarah Stern, that this means, as far as you're concerned, the relatively small number of Americans on the ground there, American forces in Syria, should remain?
Exactly. The truth is that it is very hard for me to understand why the president is talking about the less than 2,000 troops that we right now have in Syria, when we have about 5,000 remaining in Iraq and up to 15,000 in Afghanistan. And in particular, I have to say that the Syrian Kurds, especially in the Afrin region, have been tremendous, tremendous allies of ours and could have been a roadblock in this land bridge. They are in northwestern Syria, and they could easily have been wonderful allies of ours. There were, at the height, 1.2 million people in Afrin. Many of them were refugees from the 7 to 8 year long brutal Syrian civil war. And they shed their blood alongside American troops in fighting ISIS.
And Sarah, we are hard out of time, but there's so much more to talk about here, including the role Turkey is playing in assailing areas like that in Afrin. And I'm anxious to get you back to talk about that. Thank you so much for your great work. Keep it up. Come back to us again soon. Next up, Dr. Matthew Kronig will join us from Georgetown University.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is a great pleasure to have with us once again a man I've come to admire tremendously for his intellect, his extraordinary writings, and his serious approach to some of the most important and often most controversial topics of our time. He is Dr. Matthew Kronig, an associate professor in the Department of Government at my alma mater, the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgiopolitan Collegium, I think it's called, now known as Georgetown University, of course. He is also now the deputy director in the Brent Scowcroft Center at the Atlantic Council. And it's a privilege to say he has just written a new book, which I have not yet gotten to, frankly, but I think is going to be one of my favorites. It's called The Logic of American Nuclear Strategy. And it's high time someone laid that out and hopefully, as I am sure you've done, Matthew, made the case for maintaining our nuclear deterrent posture. Welcome back. It's so good to have you. Thank you for finding some time. I know you're in a cab, so we'll try to make good use of your time.
Yeah, well, thank you very much for having me on. Thanks for that very generous and kind introduction. It's always a pleasure to speak with you.
Good. Well, it's mutual. Let me ask you first, before we get to the nuclear posture, because it's part of the larger national security and foreign policy portfolio in which you're so expert, I did want to ask you about the incoming national security advisor. You are notable for having mustered out to express some skepticism for the kind of criticism that John Bolton has come in for since the president announced that he would take that position on the 9th of this month. Tell us a little bit about your views on Ambassador Bolton and why it's a good choice.
Yeah, well, I think he's very experienced, high-level experience at the State Department and at the UN, understands these issues better than anyone. If you look at his writings and media appearances over the years, clearly understands the national security challenges facing the country. He's effective at making the bureaucracy work. He has a good relationship with the president, it seems, which is essential for doing well in this role. He seems like a good choice. And I think the criticisms have really been unfair, you know, saying that he's a warmonger or whatever else. You know, we want a national security advisor who considers all options to advance U.S. interest, and military option needs to be on the table for dealing with difficult challenges like Iran and North Korea. So I think he's a good choice and think the criticism has been too hysterical.
Why do you think so? I mean, what is it about Ambassador Bolton that has precipitated this torrent of vitriol? I'm fond of pointing out myself that the statement by Joe Biden back when he was the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and considering Ambassador Bolton's nomination to be the ambassador to the United Nations, that it wasn't that he was incompetent, it's that he was too competent. Does that have something to do with it, do you think?
I think that has something to do with it. I think also it's that people in Washington are confused by somebody who actually believes in something and has principles and tries to implement them when he's in office. You know, a lot of people in this town are just interested in their own career advancement, but I think Bolton believes in certain things in terms of America's role in the world. And I think that confuses people and makes them uncomfortable.
Yeah, I think that may be part of it. I think the fact that he believes in things that are so much at odds with what passes for conventional wisdom is probably part of it, too, and that he is effective in advocating for that discordant view. I think of it kind of as a Churchillian model, much admired, interestingly enough, at the moment, as you know, because of The Darkest Hour, a film portraying it. But we don't quite see in our own time, I guess, a Churchillian figure when he's just seemingly at odds with that conventional wisdom. Matthew, let me turn to another topic where really it's very much related to the first. But one of the things, as you mentioned, that Ambassador Bolton is going to be obliged to address quickly and hopefully effectively is the problem of Iran. And you, of course, have written, I thought, an incalculably important book, Time to Attack: The Looming Iranian Nuclear Threat, which seems to be pretty much aligned with Ambassador Bolton's view. When you look at the Bolton plan, which he had advocated earlier this year to extract ourselves from this Obama bomb deal, does that seem to be the kind of approach that's needed at the moment if, in fact, there isn't going to have to be actual kinetic action to stop this threat?
Well, there's no doubt that the Iran nuclear deal has serious gaps and problems. As you know, all the limits on Iran's nuclear program expire over time. So if we just stick in the current deal, we'll be in real trouble when these limits expire. The deal doesn't cover ballistic missiles, which is a major problem. Iran's expanding its ballistic missile program. So we either have to fix the deal or nix it, as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has said. So there are a few different ways to do that. I think the steps Bolton has laid out in some of his writing make sense. I have a piece in the American Interest from a couple of years ago called How to Unwind the Iran Nuclear Deal, where I lay out my views on it. But there's no doubt that we either need to fix the deal or get out of it, because sticking with the deal is a path to nuclear-armed Iran.
Yeah, for sure. Let me ask you about this topic of your current, most recent book, Matthew, if I can. I'm, as are you, I know, very much concerned about what has been happening to our deterrent posture. The president has, I think, made it clear he's also concerned. There's a new nuclear posture review that's out. But put all this into the context, as you see it, of the logic of American nuclear strategy, the title of your new book.
Yes, this book addresses what I really see as one of the most important questions facing the country. What kind of nuclear posture and strategy do we need to protect ourselves and our allies? But also a bigger puzzle, because we have clear theories on this question. Anybody who's taken an introduction to international relations course has heard this kind of mutually assured destruction theory, that basically the United States needs enough nuclear weapons to absorb an attack and retaliate with a devastating second strike. But if we look at the real world and what the United States actually does, it's never been content with the mere second strike capability. If we were okay with that, we could have a couple of dozen nuclear weapons on submarines. But that's not what the United States has ever done. We have thousands of nuclear warheads, counterforce targeting policies and capabilities, missile defenses, and U.S. leaders have consistently shown an interest in a nuclear arsenal, as JFK, President Kennedy put it, quote, second to none. And so this book tries to explain why the United States needs such a robust nuclear posture.
And do you assess at the moment that that's what we have? I think the case for having one is compelling, and I'm delighted you're making it. I had an opportunity to visit with a colleague in the Pentagon earlier this week, and was shocked but not surprised to have him affirm the really dire straits in which this, as it's been called, the nuclear enterprise—not just the weapons themselves, but you know, the infrastructure and the supporting industrial base—have gotten into. Could you talk a little bit about that, Matt?
Yeah, you're right. It is a problem. You know, at the end of the Cold War, the United States and Russia had very different responses. The U.S. response has been to say, well, you know, nuclear weapons were to some degree Cold War relics. We want to reduce reliance on nuclear weapons, reduce the role of nuclear weapons in our national security policy. And part of that was not making the needed investments in the underlying enterprise, the Department of Energy labs, the scientists needed to sustain nuclear posture. Russia, on the other hand, for Russia, the Cold War basically never ended. They've continued their underlying nuclear enterprise. They're dreaming up these new nuclear weapons, as we saw Putin announce a couple of weeks ago. So when you look at our actual capabilities, I think that our capabilities are still second to none, as Sarah Huckabee Sanders reported a couple of weeks ago. But I do worry about the underlying enterprise, and we do need to make the investments in that capability.
Boy, I hope you're right. I have the feeling we're whistling past the graveyard when we haven't tested our nuclear weapons since 1992. We've got some parts of our industrial complex that are dating back to the Manhattan Project, literally, and simply falling down around the ears of those who are working in them. We have not designed a new nuclear weapon in, I think, decades. Certainly, we lack today the capacity to produce them. And when you contrast that with what you've rightly described as a very robust and ongoing modernization program and, it seems, secret testing program, certainly production of new weapons, it's hard to say that that meets the standard that the Russians have set, let alone the Chinese and perhaps others. But Matt, let me ask you about one particularly important piece of this that I haven't seen really addressed by just about anybody, but you did in the Wall Street Journal on the 24th of January, the case, as you put it, for tactical U.S. nuclear weapons. Tell us why it is important for us to have new tactical nuclear weapons.
The biggest threat of nuclear war that we face today, I think, comes from not from North Korea, but from Russia, because Russia has this very scary nuclear doctrine they call escalate to de-escalate. And so basically the idea is that if they get into a war with NATO, rather than risk losing that war, because NATO does have aggregate conventional superiority over Russia, rather than lose that war, Russia would start using low-yield nuclear weapons early in the conflict, basically in a bid to frighten European leaders, frighten American leaders into backing down and letting Russia win the conflict. And so this places us in what Henry Kissinger called decades ago a suicide or surrender problem. And do we retaliate with a large-scale nuclear attack, knowing full well that the Russians could retaliate with a massive attack on the U.S., or do we surrender? And so what we really need are our own kind of flexible nuclear options.
In an early part of my life, I had an opportunity to help try to get those kinds of nuclear weapons into Europe, and sadly saw that treaty come into being that I think is now being massively violated by the Russians, the INF treaty. Take them out. It's a real concern, and I appreciate so much your clarity on this as so many other issues. Dr. Matthew Kronick, thank you for joining us today and for the great work you're doing at Georgetown University and elsewhere. Keep it up. Come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Andrew Hyatt talks to us about Paul the Apostle of Christ right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is with the greatest of delight that I welcome for the first time to our microphones Andrew Hyatt, a man I have not met until just now, sadly, but I have admired from afar for quite some time because of his extraordinary creativity and, well, sheer talent as a writer and director of some very important, indeed major, motion pictures, among them Full of Grace, The Last Light, and The Frozen. He was also the creative director for another fabulous film, The Stoning of Soraya M. But to his screen credits, he has now a breathtakingly important new film entitled Paul, Apostle of Christ. Andrew Hyatt, I am thrilled to have you with us to talk about your film and the subject matter, both in the period you've been chronicling and in our own time. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It's great to have you.
I appreciate you having me. It's great to be on.
I did want to start with the film, of course. I had a chance to see it in a theater and was really blown away by both the tale you tell, the simple subject of the Apostle Paul, and the time in which he lived out his last days, but also what was going on in the Christian community in Rome, which is the focus of the film. Walk us through a little bit of the highlights of it as you see it and what you were trying to convey to your audience.
Yeah, I think it was very important to bring a real sense of humanity into this story, into a biblical film, in maybe a way that we're not used to or haven't really seen before. And one thing that was so profoundly moving, as you mentioned, is just how these first century Christians lived. And I think that we often hear these stories, all the time. We're hearing them on Sundays, we're reading them, we're very familiar. But I don't know that we ever really stop to think about the context of what these first century Christians were living in. And that was something that really impacted me and moved me, was kind of learning about the history of Rome and Emperor Nero and the persecution that was happening, and how beautiful, though, amongst the persecution, that these first century Christians, Paul included, Luke included, were living out such a beautiful version of their faith.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned Nero, and of course the film is set in the period after a terrible fire took place. Some blamed him for doing it, but he blamed the Christians and made it the pretext for his intensified persecution of them, including the incarceration and ultimately the death sentence for Paul. It's a scene that you've captured in a way that I found really extraordinary, and I have no idea the magic that you worked, but I know that it was all the more remarkable because it was done on a very tight budget. Can you share a little of that backstory with our audience? Because I think it will give them an even greater appreciation for the film when they see it.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, well, extremely small budget in the context of, studio films. $5 million budget, shot in 23 days, which is just a super quick schedule. So we really did need, the grace of God with us every step of the way to even accomplish, getting our days every day was the practicality of that was difficult. And so it was just beautiful to watch some moments, you know, and not to spoil any moments of the film, but, you know, some very intense moments, very, very dramatic moments of persecution and some of these things where, you know, we just looked at each other and said, God's got to take us through this because we have about an hour to shoot this scene and we really need to put something powerful on screen. And that's got to be beyond us.
Yeah, well, it happened. The hand of God was on the film unquestionably. And I want to ask you about one particular sort of leitmotif that ran through it that I think is so important, not only to an appreciation of the experience you were trying to capture, but also to, well, our own time. And that is the extent to which the crucible, if you will, of oppression, persecution, this incredible cruelty, in fact, even murderous mayhem, waged against people simply because they follow Jesus Christ, is a honing fire for their belief in him. And talk about how that was part of the story that you felt the need to tell as well.
I can only say personally, and hopefully the audience gets something similar out of it, which is it was very convicting. It was just convicting to me. I mean, here I am in America, and, you know, I get to read my Bible every morning. I get to go to church on Sunday. And, you know, maybe the worst thing that I get is a mean message on Facebook or something like that. I mean, I have no context and concept for what the early church and our brothers and sisters around the world are dealing with for their faith. And so it was just so convicting to me to kind of learn. I don't know why in my mind, you know, quick anecdote, you know, I saw Paul, you know, kind of maybe out on a lakeside villa writing these beautiful theological treatises and books on theology. I don't know why I pictured that. And then here I am digging into the story, realizing Paul is saying the things that he said, these beautiful, passionate things, while he's being stoned, while he's being beaten and flogged and put in prison. And I thought, wow, I just don't have any context of that kind of faith. And it strengthened my faith. And I hope that it makes us all stop to think. And by the way, pray for our brothers and sisters that are dealing with this, you know, literally today in 2018 for their faith.
Indeed. I wanted to turn to that next with you again. Our guest is Andrew Hyatt. He is the writer and director of Paul, Apostle of Christ, a major motion picture now in theaters. I strongly encourage you all to check it out. This point about the persecution today has moved me and a lot of others to seek, as you may know, Andrew, to take advantage of the kind of creative product you've just presented and any other opportunity, for that matter, to highlight what is happening around the world, as you say. A lot of attention has been focused on the Middle East, where, you know, we finally got the previous administration to declare that it was a genocide against Christians. But unfortunately, it's lots of other parts of the world as well. And this idea that it's real people suffering unbelievable hardship, and in some cases sacrificing their lives simply because of their convicted, if you will, as you're saying, in their faith in Christ. I just thought this was, you know, sort of providential, to say the least, that your film was out as we were launching this new Save the Persecuted Christians coalition to try to both raise the visibility of the problem and begin to hold those responsible for the persecution accountable. So it's a gift from God, as far as I'm concerned.
And it's beautiful to hear that there are yourself and others out there that are focused on this and passionate about it, because it really is an issue. It's a major, major issue. And I think hopefully what the film can do is not only shed light on it, but also just show the beauty of what that conviction looks like. How can you, you know, again, it's hard for us in America to think, how can you walk out to your death joyfully? How can you go to your death at peace? Well, but that's the gospel. That's what Jesus Christ was all about. That's what he was telling his followers, you know, do not be afraid, you know. And I think that the movie will not only shed light on the issue, but I hope that it does give us a real grace and a real joy to see, whoa, that faith, that's a deep, deep faith. And maybe I need to kind of think a little deeper about my own.
Yeah. And I guess that's where I wanted to just wrap up with you, Andrew, is this challenge in part of raising awareness about the plight of persecuted Christians around the world to whom you dedicate your film. And I want to credit you for doing that. It was marvelous to see that coming up in the closing screens. But it highlights the fact that, as you were saying about some in this country feel as though they're somewhat oppressed, how important it is really for those of us who understand the true magnitude of the danger. Some have estimated, I think Open Doors has put a number of 215 million Christians around the world at the moment suffering not just, you know, hardship and difficulty finding work and that sort of thing, but heavy persecution of the kind you documented going back to the first century, for heaven's sakes. But the point is, Andrew, that we have to, it seems to me, be awakening people of faith, and notably, but not exclusively, I would hope, people of the Christian faith, to this problem. And I think you've done such an incredibly important public service by doing this so magnificently in a film from many, many centuries ago, and yet it lives on in our own time.
Well, I just appreciate that, and we do hope that it does raise this awareness. And really, the best thing could be is if audiences, especially in America, can leave the theater, they kind of maybe put their head up instead of their head down and go right back to their normal routine and say, whoa, like, there's a real powerful thing happening here. And this is not just a nice feeling. I don't just go to church for a nice feeling and some good songs. There is a power here and a real deep faith that people are willing to die for and willing to die for, not just it's too bad it's happening. And of course, it's terrible that it's happening. But that's a deep, deep faith that I would hope that we can all kind of be inspired to. I mean, we should look at our brothers and sisters around the world and look to them as the example of what a deep faith looks like. Look at them and say, whoa, okay. And as you say, if I'm not experiencing that persecution, well, how can I help? And that may just be remembering to pray, you know, the power of prayer.
Well, it's a starting point. And, you know, just on your last point there, so many of the stories that are coming forth now, of course, as I'm sure you know, involve people who are given a choice of living, if only they will abandon their faith, and choosing voluntarily, as you say, to retain their faith and lose their lives. I just wanted to close by saying that this is such an important time. And one of the things we're trying to do with this campaign, to your point about people coming and going in churches, to encourage houses of worship, not just churches, you know, others as well, to place banners outside of the churches so that the parishioners or the congregants, as well as people just driving by, can see the importance of, as it says, save the persecuted Christians as a takeaway. I think you're doing that with your film, Paul, Apostle of Christ, Andrew Hyatt. I cannot thank you enough, and I especially appreciate your time today. All I can say is go forth and multiply, and we'll see what we can do on our end as well. God bless you. Next up, we'll speak with Andrew Goldman about economic warfare and more right after this.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back. We are joined, as we have the privilege of being quite regularly, by David Goldman, a.k.a. Spengler. That is his nom de guerre at Asia Times, for whom he writes regularly. He is the author of How Civilizations Die, and a brilliant economist and, well, extraordinary commentator on matters involving our economic security and other matters of concern to all of us here at Secure Freedom Radio. It's a delight to welcome him back. David, thank you for joining us.
Frank, always a privilege.
So, there is this trade war in the offing, we're told, with communist China. You follow the Chinese very closely. They have responded in some degree preemptively to what Donald Trump is saying he will do. And yet, we're also told that there is now a very active negotiation underway to head this off. What do you make of it all, and where do you think it's going to sort?
I think the president and his advisors are absolutely right to challenge China's attempt to dominate trade in the high-tech industry. I'm not sure that the instruments they've chosen are necessarily the most effective. And in fact, as the rebound in the stock market tells us, what we have from both our country and China right now are feints as opposed to really hard punches. The problem is China massively subsidizes high-tech, technology-intensive, capital-intensive industries. So all the inventions, from flat-panel TVs to sensors to the semiconductors that we made in the United States, have migrated to Asia because they're capital-intensive and the government subsidizes it. That costs us jobs, costs us national security advantages. Tariffs are not necessarily the best way to do it, and the global supply chain is so interlinked that it's hard to hit tariffs without actually hurting people, including ourselves. So it's a very delicate thing to do. My concern is that we really need a Ronald Reagan-style strategic defense initiative, military tech driver to leapfrog the Chinese in innovation. That's what I think would really win this war. Right now, you know, the fog of war still envelops what the president is actually thinking.
But it does seem as though the blunt instrument, if you will, of tariffs has gotten the Chinese attention to the matter, and certainly called attention to it on the part of an awful lot of other Americans who probably, unlike your good self and a few others of us, were oblivious to the kind of trade policies and subsidies and predatory efforts to acquire or simply steal intellectual property. I've heard an estimate, and I know that all of this is not Chinese, it's a worldwide loss to the United States, I've told on the order of $600 billion a year in terms of expropriated intellectual property. It's a little hard for me to believe there's that much intellectual property coming on stream each year to be stolen or otherwise acquired, but it's shocking, isn't it?
It's a lot. If the object of the president is to get everyone's attention and force the kind of negotiations which would help remedy the problem, this will turn out to be a very good initiative. If he thinks tariffs as such are the solution, it may blow up in our face. So I'm very reluctant to criticize him because I don't know what he has in mind. He's obviously got a lot of cards close to his chest. But what I will say is that I am much less worried about the theft of intellectual property in the past than by the risk that the Chinese may leapfrog us in critical new innovation.
But I guess my point is, David, it seems to me some of that is a function of what they've managed to get their hands on, as well as what they're doing to innovate, is it not?
Well, that's true, but the innovations are really worrying. For example, Huawei, the great Chinese telecommunications equipment and handset company, now is producing mobile phone chips that can compete with Qualcomm. President was absolutely right to stop Qualcomm being taken over by a Singapore company, Broadcom, because it might give the Chinese advantages. But the bigger risk is that the Chinese themselves are going to leapfrog us, or at least go nose to nose with us in technologies where we do have an advantage. If the Chinese can innovate faster than we can, we are in very serious trouble.
And again, this brings to mind another question related to transactions like the Broadcom deal. It's somewhat unique that the government intervenes to prohibit a transaction, in this case, acquiring a hostile takeover an important technology company in the United States, Qualcomm.
No, it was great that Trump did it. I applaud him.
This is really my point, is that it's the exception to the rule. And by and large, it's been my experience, David Goldman, that most of these sorts of deals, as long as there's some commercial benefit ascribed to it, will, you know, get sort of the blind eye, if you will, from the government. They will not investigate. They will not interpose any objections if it has obvious national security implications. One example of which is playing out as we speak. The port of Wilmington, Delaware, tomorrow is expected to essentially turn over the port for an infusion of something on the order of $589 million to a company that is out of the UAE but has as a joint venture partner the family of Saddam Hussein's bomb maker. One would think this would have triggered a national security alarm, but not so, at least as of yet.
Well, it certainly seems that like somebody was asleep at the switch. trouble is, American companies make money in the short term by giving the family jewels away. You get very good prices for handing over the family jewels, and companies like Boeing and Intel, Texas Instruments, who are very active in China, are told by the Chinese, if you want access to our 1.4 billion person market, you have to give us the technology. So from the standpoint of a CEO who's looking at stock options that vests in 5 years, looks like a great deal. From the standpoint of American national security at a 10-year horizon, it's a terrible deal.
Very troubling indeed. David, let me turn to one other issue which we touch on from time to time, and I gather that there have been some developments that are pretty ominous on this front as well, and that is efforts the Chinese seem now to be increasingly aggressively pursuing to displace the dollar as the reserve currency of the world, starting with, it appears, the petrodollar, now being supplanted, it seems, by the petro yuan. Is that a serious new development, and should we be concerned?
This is a slow march towards dominance. It's a 5 to 10 year plan to become the dominant economic power in the world. It's not something we're going to see the effect of tomorrow. What they've added is one important arrow to their quiver, the ability to trade oil futures in RMB, in their national currency. The Chinese financial system is still so overregulated and communist and inefficient that you can't persuade the world to hold their balances in dollars. You know, if you're a Finnish exporter and you own dollars, you can buy stocks, bonds, money market funds, futures, options, anything you want, and transact 24 hours a day. You can't do that in the Chinese market, which is still very closed, subject to the capital controls and so forth. And Xi Jinping has appointed his friends Liu He, who's the vice premier, to deregulate and de-risk the Chinese financial system over the next several years so they can get to the point of competing with the United States. The risk is if we get into a trade war, a lot of the other Asians are going to move towards the Chinese scheme of supplant of the dollar. And as you look at where people are holding reserves, a lot of reserves are moving away from the dollar to other currencies than the dollar. That's because, you know, we're borrowing $1 trillion a year. We can't keep pushing our debt up and expect to hold our debt around the world indefinitely.
Especially without raising our interest rates considerably, with profound implications for that debt. David, just one quick question on this. I understand that the so-called petro yuan or renminbi is being backed by gold. To what extent does that enter into investors' calculations?
Well, it just means that you can denominate a futures contract in RMB or gold. It's a convenience. That does not yet obviate the problem that when you hold RMB, you've got limited investment options and limited capital mobility. The world is not going to put their money into Chinese currency until that market is sufficiently open to make it attractive.
Sufficiently open or sufficiently large, perhaps, especially if it's now being expanded quite a ways in the name of the so-called One Belt, One Road, Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, as we've called it. We have to leave it at that for the moment. There is so much more to talk about. I hope that you will come back to us again very soon. Thank you for your time today. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.